Tonight, the supermoon. Maybe you've heard about this.
This weekend, the full moon will be closer to Earth than at any other time this year. Astronomers have a name for it, supermoon.
The moon will be 15,000 miles closer, 30% brighter. I had to know more, so I called up Philip Plait.
I'm an astronomer and blogger for Discover Magazine, and I live in Boulder, Colorado.
Okay, so Phil, this happens only once like every 1,000 years, right?
No, it's actually pretty common. It happened last year.
Oh.
In fact, it happened last month in April.
Huh.
It was not really any farther than it is this weekend. It's only going to be about 1,000 miles closer. So really, if this were such a big deal, why weren't people talking about it last month? And the fact that you didn't see emails and tweets and Facebook and all that stuff lighting up about this shows that this is just basically hype.
So why did I even call you?
Well, look, I don't want to stop people from going out and looking up at the sky. It will be bigger, will be brighter, you're probably not going to notice. But it's still the moon. It's gorgeous. It's the Earth's natural satellite. It's profoundly impacted the evolution of life on this planet for 1 billion years. That's probably enough reason to go out and look at it. You don't have to go out because of sort of this overblown hype.
And you're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. And if you're just joining us, you're listening to Weekends and All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Guy Raz. At the NFL draft last week, Stanford's Andrew Luck and Baylor's Robert Griffin III were the first and second picks. Luck to the Indianapolis Colts. Griffin comes here to Washington, D.C. and the Redskins. Both of these men are young, just 22 years old, now very rich and with very little life experience. So it prompted a former NFL player, Nate Jackson, a one-time tight end for the Denver Broncos, to write an open letter to the two young quarterbacks.
Dear Andrew Luck and Robert Griffin III, you've been mentioned in the same breath for the last several months, but once you get drafted and shake hands with Darth Vader, your lives will diverge and you'll be immersed fully in the identity of your new employers.
That is, of course, former Denver Broncos tight end Nate Jackson, reading from the letter he posted online a few days ago. Nate Jackson, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Can you carry on reading a bit more?
Certainly. Immediately following the draft, you'll board a private jet to your new cities, where you will step off the plane as hope. Whether leading your teams to triumph or failing miserably, every breath will be a public affair. For better or for worse, your privacy is gone.
You make the NFL sound miserable.
Well, I have a problem with the commercialization of the NFL. I love the game of football, but I don't love the game around the game of football. And when I was playing it, I couldn't really voice that opinion. I couldn't be honest about it. And truthfully, I felt kind of ashamed of having that opinion, like I should be behind everything that the NFL does because it is the highest level of football in the world. But when I think about it with my own thoughts and my own mind, I just don't like the direction it's going.
You remind us that these huge overnight celebrities are in their early 20s. And in the letter, you outline a vision of their respective futures. And this is what you write. You say,
after negotiating your contracts, you both will surely buy a house in an affluent suburb where no 22-year-old would be happy living. Your new neighbors will be rich as well, facelifted, liposucked, Xanaxed and dripping in diamonds, simply delighted to welcome you to the neighborhood. You will commission an interior decorator, recommended by a neighbor, to furnish your home. This will guarantee it feels nothing like home. And someday, when all this is over, you'll walk through and gaze upon the marble columns and the embroidered drapes like artifacts in a museum, wondering why you ever listened to that woman.
Nate Jackson, is this what Andrew Luck and Robert Griffin III, is this their future?
I hope not. It's more of a cautionary tale. I know this does happen to some men who, especially first-round picks, the ones that are thoroughly hyped by the NFL and are surrounded by yes-men and people who want to usher them into this new stage of their lives. And when you come into a lot of money as a young man, the tendency is to want to buy a house where other members of your income level would be living. But the irony is that no one there relates to you.
The amazing thing about this letter is, and you call them hope, And it sounds like the entire city places all of its faith in this kid. And that's a lot of pressure.
It certainly is a lot of pressure for many reasons. Certainly the quarterback is a very important part of the team, but he's only one player on the team. And the nuance of that reality is lost in the media hype, because they like to accentuate certain characters that end up selling the brand of the NFL. It's not as exciting or sexy to say these are 53 guys that make up this team. They win or lose together. But inside the locker room, there's a knowledge that that is bogus. So when I said that inside the locker room is the only place where he's safe and where his struggle will be understood, I say that because that's the only place where the nuance of the reality of a football team is understood.
That's Nate Jackson. He played tight end for the Denver Broncos. His open letter to NFL draft picks Andrew Luck and Robert Griffin III was written for BuzzFeed. You can find a link to that at our website, npr.org. Nate Jackson, thank you so much.
Thank you, Guy. Appreciate it.
Is there a movie you never get tired of? One, you know, where you can practically recite every line by heart? Well, over the next few months, we're going to ask the people who make movies about those films that shaped who they are today.
My name is Lawrence Kasdan. I'm a movie director, screenwriter, producer. And the movie I've seen a million times is Out of the Past, directed by Jacques Tourneur, starring Robert Mitchum and Jane Greer and Kirk Douglas. I've probably seen it 8 or 9 times. It is a film noir and one of the best ever made. Every scene has got great things, and it's very funny. It's very wised up in the manner of film noir.
Hello, Marnie.
Well, look who's back.
You dye your hair.
Why?
I always keep thinking of you as a blonde.
For all the thinking you do about me, I could be bald-headed.
The Robert Mitchum character is a former private eye who's been involved with some ugly things and has straightened out and now runs a gas station in a small California town. And the beginning of the movie is all sunlit and cheerful. But as you get deeper into the story, you see his history, and that's a very dark, complicated history. And he becomes involved with a beautiful woman. It was Jane Greer making her debut.
You know, you're a curious man.
You're going to make every guy you meet a little bit curious.
It's not what I mean. You don't ask questions. You don't even ask me what my name is.
All right, what's your name?
Kathy.
I like it.
She's the girlfriend of Kirk Douglas. Kirk Douglas hires Robert Mitchum to find Jane Greer, who has taken off with some of his money.
She ran out on me.
With $40,000.
I want it back.
All the money?
And Mitchum finds her, falls in love with her, tries to run away with her, gets caught, and they get involved in a terrible scheme, and then they're separated. There's one amazing scene when he is reunited with Jane Greer, who has totally betrayed him.
You remember Kathy, don't you?
Yeah, I remember Kathy.
She's gone back to Kirk Douglas, but now she comes in secretly to talk to Robert Mitchum, and he's totally disgusted by her presence, doesn't believe a word she says. And there's a bit of dialogue that I thought was some of the greatest ever written.
Jeff, I've missed you. I've wondered about you. Prayed you'd understand.
And he looks at her with such cynicism and weariness, and he says...
You prayed, Kathy?
She continues to try to convince him, and he says...
Well, just get out, will you? I have to sleep in this room.
Get out of here. I have to sleep in this room.
Let's just leave it where it all is. Get out.
Pretty tough stuff. The whole language of the underworld and the understanding that the characters have of each other, you feel like you're being led into a secret world.
That's writer and director Lawrence Kasdan, best known for The Big Chill, talking about the movie that changed his life. Out of the Past. Kasdan's new film, Darling Companion, is in theaters now. It's Weekends on All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Guy Raz.
As President Obama said this week, a China that protects the rights of all its citizens will be a stronger and more prosperous nation. And, of course, a stronger partner on behalf of our common goals.
Secretary of State Hillary Clinton speaking from Beijing this week, where she was visiting for the U.S.-China Strategic Dialogue talks. These are 2 days of annual meetings held between Washington and Beijing. And this year, of course, those talks were overshadowed by the events surrounding the dissident Chen Guangcheng. But James Fallows of The Atlantic, who writes often about China, was watching those talks closely. And Jim, first of all, explain the backstory to these annual talks.
Yes, this is a legacy of the George W. Bush administration, where under mainly the impetus of then-Secretary of the Treasury Hank Paulson, they decided it would be good to have a regular annual occasion for getting together at the highest levels between the Chinese and American government. So it was called then the Strategic Economic Dialogue Talks, now with the different emphasis of the Obama administration as the Strategic and Economic Dialogues. And it's mainly a way to have a routine, guaranteed forum to resolve a lot of the always difficult issues between the two countries.
And of course, not just Hillary Clinton was there, but Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner. Does the U.S. do this with any other country in the world?
Not in this form, because there's no other relationship just like the one between the U.S. and China. In dealings with NATO, it's a very friendly relationship. In dealings with the Soviet Union in the old days, it's an overall very hostile relationship. This is a unique interaction in that it's both cooperative in many ways and hostile and confrontational in some others. And so I think that's the special role of these discussions.
Well, obviously, the case of Chen Guangcheng dominated the news coverage of what happened there, but there were things that did actually happen. What was the U.S. after in those talks?
The agenda for Hillary Clinton would have been to seek China's broader engagement on a range of international issues, to have its help in Syria, with Iran and North Korea and with Burma and all these other areas where the Chinese government, its natural inclination would be to avoid doing anything. On the Treasury Secretary side, the agenda would have been things like the value of the Chinese currency, intellectual property protection in China. The talks were mainly on those two fronts.
What did they achieve?
From the initial reports, as if the Chinese gave a lot of what the U.S. was looking for, especially on the economic realm. The Chinese government announced that the giant state-owned enterprises that play such a large role in the Chinese economy would have to start paying dividends. If they didn't have to pay dividends, essentially that was a built-in war chest that they could use to subsidize a lot of their efforts worldwide. In the last month or so, the Chinese central bank has significantly increased the trading range for the Chinese currency, and the equivalent of their export-import bank has agreed to rein back some of the export subsidies that both the Europeans and the United States have been complaining about a lot.
Jim, for years now, the thinking among U.S. policymakers was, you know, you open our markets to China, that will create a Chinese middle class. China will have to liberalize, become more democratic. That clearly has not happened. The latest State Department human rights report about China was pretty damning.
Yes, the crudest version of that equation, which we heard a lot of, say, 20 or 30 years ago, which is more trade would mean a democratic China, that clearly is not true. There's a refined version of it, which actually does become important for China in the next generation or two, which is whether its move from this low-wage manufacturing economy to a more sophisticated, prosperous one will require a kind of opening the government has not been able to do so far. And that is, we'll see how that unfolds.
That's James Fallows of The Atlantic. He joins us here most Saturdays. Jim, thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Guy.
It's Weekends and All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Guy Raz, and I'm just going to, bear with me, pull up an email that I wrote recently to Ben Zimmer. Hold on. And he is the language columnist at the Boston Globe. Okay, here's what I wrote. Dear Ben, every 20-something on our show, on the staff, uses the word meta all the time, as in, that's so meta, dude. So what's going on? Because I'd been hearing this all the time. I had no idea what it actually meant. So Ben wrote back this very, very long email to me, and instead of reading it to you, we just asked Ben to come onto the program. Ben, are you there?
I'm right here.
Okay. That's so meta, dude, that is meta. What is meta? When did I miss something?
Well, meta has long been a prefix from Greek and meaning above and beyond.
Metaphysical.
Exactly. Yeah. The metaphysical is a step beyond the physical realm.
Yeah.
And you could also talk about meta language, meta commentary, something that's a higher level of abstraction or analysis. So that was used in lots of different academic and professional settings, and it eventually started getting used just as a standalone adjective. The way it gets used now really refers to anything that is self-referential self-parodying in some way in this kind of recursive fashion.
Ben, clearly you've been thinking a lot about this because when I sent you an email, I think I got a response like 15 minutes later with all of these examples, including one that you were thinking about for a while. This happened in your native town of New York City. What happened?
Well, last December, I think I really realized exactly how meta a world we're living in. It was while the Occupy Wall Street movement was still hanging on in Lower Manhattan, there was something very strange going on. There was a TV show, Law & Order Special Victims Unit, that had set up a replica of that Occupy Wall Street encampment in another spot, Foley Square, not far from where the actual encampment was.
They set it up to film it.
Yeah, exactly. So they were going to dramatize the Occupy movement for the show.
So where were you six last night?
Uptown at a drum circle outside the mayor's house?
But then the real-life occupiers who were getting kicked out of Zuccotti Park got wind of this. They said, hey, there's a mockupation going on. So they showed up.
Occupy Wall Street is not for sale.
And occupied the TV set.
Protesters say they don't want TV to co-opt their movement.
And on Twitter, they were using hashtags like Occupy, Occupy Wall Street. Eventually, the occupiers got kicked out by real police, and the whole thing was over. But while that was happening, I was just amazed. I mean, this was truly a meta moment and somehow really seemed to encapsulate how everything in the culture now can become self-referential, self-conscious, self-parodying, and create this kind of endless feedback loop.
Okay, while I have you here, Ben, I'm going to take advantage of your expertise, and I want to ask you about a few other things. Random. That's so random. That is so random.
Yeah, we do hear random quite a lot, and it's interesting, like meta, words that get used a lot very often will tell us something about what the culture is going through right now. We can experience a lot of randomness in online culture that mixes different elements that normally wouldn't go together. There's all sorts of mashups of stylistically different songs and all sorts of unexpected experiences. But people are using random these days as a kind of all-purpose label for anything out of the norm. And it can become just a catch-all description, sometimes injected into the conversation with a kind of a sing-song quality like random. So it almost becomes a refrain. And that is actually another kind of meta-commentary on whatever is happening in the situation.
Awkward.
Awkward is another one that has that sing-song quality, exactly.
Yeah.
So it's a way of lightening the mood, perhaps. There's something unexpected or something that makes you a little uncomfortable. So saying something like random or awkward might help to diffuse the situation. On the other hand, it could have the opposite effect. If you say awkward, you might also be drawing attention to the awkwardness if there's an awkward silence or something like that that you're trying to fill up. So it's a double-edged sword.
Like Ben Zimmer is in a room with his wife and his ex-girlfriend of 20 years, and his wife says, awkward.
That would certainly draw attention to the situation.
That's linguist Ben Zimmer. He's the executive producer of Visual Thesaurus and a language columnist for the Boston Globe. Ben, thank you. I now have expanded my vocabulary.
Well, it's my pleasure.
Brought a song into this world. Just a melody.